It's a pleasure to introduce our next speaker, who is Michael Mossinghoff from Davidson College. Michael's talk is going to be on a subject close to my heart and the hearts of several grad students who are busy right now but will be avidly watching the talk online in a couple of days. So this is a very interesting crossover from number theory, the central part of this conference, to one of the classical problems of digital sequence design, which has kept communications engineers and discrete mathematicians busy for more than 50 years. So I don't actually know how to pronounce the name of the gentleman whose surname begins with the letter W, but there's some madness going on.
Thank you, Jonathan. So I'd like to talk today about, an old problem involving Barker sequences, a problem in sequence design, and some substantial computations that were involved in some recent work on this problem involving Wieferich primes, so things that come up often in various number theory problems. So let's see if I can get underway here. Here we go. Okay. So let me start off by saying a few words about just Barker sequences in general. I'll tell you what those are. So start with a sequence of length n, each term plus or minus 1, and define its kth aperiodic autocorrelation, denoted by C sub k. And it's very simple. It's just the sum of products of pairs of terms from your sequence, which were k apart in the original sequence. Okay. So just sum ai, ai plus k. So C sub k will have n minus k terms there. So for k equals 0, this is called the peak autocorrelation, and that's simple enough. It's just the length of the term, each of the terms for plus or minus 1, so that's just n. And positive k1s are called the off-peak autocorrelations. And, let's see, I defined the aperiodic autocorrelations. I may as well define the periodic autocorrelations while I'm here. And they're, defined in the same way, but now I'll just wrap the sequence around. So gamma sub k will be the sum of pairs of sequences of sums of products of pairs of terms, which are k apart in the original sequence, but now I just wrap around. Okay, so now each gamma sub k has n terms in that sum. Okay. Right, so, if I look at gamma sub 2, for example, I could write down the terms that are 2 apart before I wrap, and then I'll write down the couple of terms that are 2 apart after I wrap. Okay, and, I could just see that the first line there is C sub 2, and the second line is just C sub n minus 2. And in fact, in general, gamma sub k will just be C sub k plus C sub n minus k. Okay? So some of the two of the off peaks gives me the two of the off peak aperiodic autocorrelations gives me the periodic one. Okay? Okay. So the main question here is the interesting property is to try to make all your off peak autocorrelations as small as possible, and this comes from the origins of the problem in signal processing and digital sequence design. So the best you can hope for is each C sub k to be at most 1. Each C sub k is, of course, a sum of some number of plus or minus 1s, maybe an odd number, maybe an even number. So the best I could hope for is to make that at most 1. Okay. And why don't I would just call the other one, if I make the gamma sub k is all at most 1, why don't we call that a periodic Barker sequence? Okay. Right. So here's a list of some Barker sequences. Okay, up through length 13. So if you check the aperiodic autocorrelations in each one of these, you'll get 0 plus or minus 1 in every case. And of course, it gets more difficult as you go down in the list. But that's not just a list of some known Barker sequences. That's a list of all known Barker sequences. And the main question is this a complete list? Okay. So let me start with just an example here. Coming in, here they are. Okay. So here's a sequence of 7 plus or minus 1s in a row. And let's just compute the aperiodic autocorrelation. So if I look at C sub 1, well, then effectively I just need to do a dot product of the sequence with a shifted copy of itself down by 1 and ignore the overlaps. So I can just represent it this way. And if you just look at the overlaps, you'll see 3 places where the signs are the same and 3 places where they're different. So C1 is 0 there for this sequence. And you can just march right down the list. You try this one, now the different ones outnumber the sames by 1, C1 is minus, C2 is minus 1, and just march your way down there and you can check in each case, okay, that you'll get zeros or in fact minus 1s in this case all the way down. So I've got a nice Barker sequence here. Okay. Now do the same trick, but now let's compute the same sequence and try the periodic autocorrelations and compute them with these. And I'll color them this time, and let's wrap the purple one around in front, and then just count, and you'll see that the difference outnumber the same by 1, so gamma 1 is minus 1. Let's bring that that blue one up in front, and then the aqua-looking one. And you keep going, and in each case, you'll get gammas or minus 1s for the same sequence here. Okay? So this will work all the way down the line. Okay, so so this periodic, this aperiodic, this Barker sequence is also a periodic Barker sequence, and well, that's no accident. So I want to talk about the Barker sequence problem in a somewhat broader context in the periodic problem. So so this is one well-known theorem about these things, that if you have a Barker sequence, then it's automatically a periodic Barker sequence. Okay, and the proof is pretty quick here. So let me just show you this proof. So note that if A and B are both plus or minus one. Okay, then the product AB, I could represent mod 4 as A plus B minus 1. And you can just check that in each of the four cases. It works just fine in all cases. So if I wanted to compute C sub K, well, I'll just replace the sum over AI times AI plus K with the sum over that thing on the right side. Okay, and well, then if I subtract out 2 CK from CK and CK plus 1, I'll just get a simple expression over on the right side here. And that expression on the right side is invariant if I replace k by n minus 1 minus k. So let's do that and get the same thing on the right side. Okay, so those two left sides are the same. And then, well, if I just rearrange this, I'll see that c sub k plus cn minus k is congruent to ck plus 1 plus cn minus 1 minus k. Okay, but if they're congruent mod 4, remember this was a Barker sequence to begin with, so they actually have to be equal mod 4. Each of those c's were plus or minus 1 or 0. Okay, and well, on the left side then, I've just got a gamma k. On the right side, I've got a gamma k plus 1. So if you have a Barker sequence, then all the gammas are the same, at least. Okay, and now the c sub k's, remember, were 0 plus or minus 1. So, well, the only thing I have to eliminate now is to check and see that these gammas couldn't all be 2 or all be minus 2. Okay, so that's easy enough to do. This is impossible because, well, say c sub n minus k has k terms. So if it's plus or minus 1, then k is odd. But this statement is independent of k. Okay, so not all the gammas could be 2 as long as n was bigger than 2. Okay, so all the gammas are at most 1, and your Barker sequence is also a periodic Barker sequence. Okay. So the main problem that I alluded to earlier is to determine if there are any more Barker sequences then with length bigger than 13. And there's quite a bit known on this problem. So in 1961, Turin and Sturer proved that, well, the table that I showed is complete for odd n. Okay, there's no more odd ones. And there were only 2 even lengths in the table there, and the longest was 4. So is there a Barker sequence with even length bigger than 4? Okay. Before I go further, I've got a picture of Erdős. Here, and one quick application of a long Barker sequence. If you could construct longer Barker sequences, they would have interesting properties in analysis and various problems in number theory. And here's one, a conjecture of Erdős's from the early 60s. Suppose f is a polynomial with all plus or minus 1 coefficients and degree less than n, and degree n minus 1. And well, let double bar f sub infinity denote the suit norm of f around the unit circle. This is certainly bigger than the L2 norm, which is root n, and Erdős conjectured that the normalized suit norm divided by L2 norm is bounded away from 1, okay, as long as f had positive degree. There's a stronger form of this due to Golay, a conjecture of Golay's, given originally in a different language. It's called the merit factor conjecture, which just states that the L4 norm, the usual L4 norm around the unit circle, is bounded away from the L2 norm. Okay, so it's a stronger version of the Erdős conjecture. But if the coefficients of f were to form a Barker sequence of length n, okay, then it's pretty easy to show that the normalized L4 norm has to be quite small. It's less than 1 plus 1 over 4n. Okay. And for this and other sort of analytic properties of long Barker sequences are discussed in a paper of Peters and mine on flatness properties of such polynomials. It's in a recent book that was edited by James McKee and Chris Smith. So I talked about Barker sequences. So let me talk about another related problem on circulant Hadamard matrices, so a classic problem in combinatorics. Okay. Recall that a Barker sequence with n at least 4, all the gammas are constant, but the n is even, so the gamma has to be 0. Okay. And if the gamut is zero, well, this is just says that if I think of the, well, the sequence as being a vector of length n, all plus or minus ones, then it's orthogonal to all cyclic shifts of itself. And so we could also say this in a more compact way, maybe, is saying that the circulant matrix that you make from the sequence is Hadamard. So by circulant matrix, I just mean that, you know, rho k is made from rho k minus 1 by cyclically shifting the rho by 1. And by Hadamard, I mean that, well, you get equality, and Hadamard is inequality for the determinant. So compactly, HH transpose is just n times the identity. As an example then, well, I could make a circulant Hadamard matrix then just by writing down my Barker sequence of length 4 and cyclically shifting the rows and go down. So can you write down another circulant Hadamard matrix? Well, sort of, only this one. Okay. All right. So are there any more circulant Hadamard matrices with order n bigger than 4? Okay. So this contains the Barker sequence problem inside of it. Okay. But this one is also open. But there's a number of restrictions known on n. Okay, so this is what I want to talk about here. So let's talk about some of these restrictions. Okay, so first, it's easy to show that n has to be a square. Okay, if n's the order of a circulant Hadamard matrix or an even length Barker sequence, you've got to be a square. Okay, certainly it's an even number, so we want to show it's n is 4m squared. So I just have to show it's a square here. And this is also an easy proof, a well-known proof. But let me just show you how this one works. So let Jn be the n by n matrix of all ones. Okay. And suppose I got a circulant Hadamard matrix H, and let E be the sum of the entries just across one of the rows. Well, then if I just write down HH transpose times Jn, well, HH transpose is just n times the identity, so I just get the matrix of all n's. Okay, again there. But if you just regroup the parentheses, then, well, you'll add up across the rows of the H in the first piece there, so you get a matrix of all E's, and then you'll sum over the columns, you get the same thing, and you get an E squared J in there, a matrix of all E squares. Okay, so N's a square, okay? Okay, and you're set. Okay? Okay, so the first restriction is only squares are possible. Okay? Okay. Let's see, so Turin also proved that not only is N a square, but that m part has to be in fact an odd number. No more twos can go in there, and it's got to be a prime power. It can't be a prime power. Okay. All right. So Turin also published what's called the self-conjugacy test. It's a little more complicated, but it fits on a slide. It's not too bad. I'll show you how this one works. Okay. So let me say that A is semi-primitive mod B for integers A and B. Okay. If a power of A makes minus 1 mod B, okay? You can make you can take a power of A to make minus 1, okay? So minus 1 is in that subgroup generated by A, okay? And then we'll say that R is self-conjugate mod S, okay? If, well, for each prime P dividing R, okay, P is semi-primitive, well, you want to say mod S, but, you know, if S was divisible by P, it wouldn't have a hope of working, okay? So to give it a chance, you'd want to take out all the P's out of S first. Okay, so if every prime divisor of R is semi-primitive mod the p-free part of S. Okay. And so Turin's theorem then you can write down this way. So if n's the order of a circulant Hadamard matrix, okay, and I pick two integers R and S. R divides m, S divides n, and R and S have to have something in common. Okay, GCD is at least one prime divisor in common. Let's call that K prime divisors in common. Okay. And there it is. And R is self-conjugate mod S. Okay. If all those things work out, okay, the stars just align perfectly here, okay, then RS can't be too big. Okay. All right. So the way you want to play this, of course, is you want to see if you can use this theorem to exclude N as a rank of a circulant Hadamard matrix. So you want to pick R and S in a creative way, which satisfies all those constraints to get RS as big. Okay. All right. So as a special case, I'll call the large prime test. Okay. If you're an order of a Barker, if you're a length of a Barker sequence or order of a circulant Hadamard matrix, then your length can't have a large prime factor. Okay. So the proof of this is just follows straight from the self-conjugacy test. Say P divides M. So N is 4M squared. N is the candidate order. So let's take R to be P, okay, and S is 2P squared. Okay. And, well, then, well, P trivially, R is semi-primitive mod the P-free part of S, which is 2. Okay, so P to a power is minus 1 mod 2. Sure, that works. Okay, so R is trivially self-conjugate mod S. Okay, and well, so the conclusion of the theorem says, well, I need PQ to be less than 2m squared. Okay, so so the corollary then is that, let's just, you can replace P by P to the K here. If I have, say, P to the K divides M, and P to the 3K is bigger than 2M squared, okay, then, well, then no circulant head of R matrix of order 4M squared exists, okay? Okay, so, if N is gonna work, it can't have a prime divisor that's bigger than, like, N to the 2/3 or so, okay? Okay, so that's handy. Okay. And, a third restriction I'll call, Schmidt's inequality. Let me define nu sub p of m, as usual, to be the multiplicity of p in the factorization of m, just how many times p occurs in m. Okay. And just to, for handy notation, let m sub q be the q-free and square-free part of m. Okay, so just the product of all the primes that divide m, but don't put q in there if q divides m. Okay, and bpm is an integer, okay, that you construct in the following way. So you take the maximum over all primes q that divide m, well, except p. Okay, so we'll define bpm for each prime p dividing m. Okay, so take the maximum of the following quantity over all the primes q dividing m, except for p. And first, what you want to do is count the number of times p divides q to the p minus 1 minus 1. Okay. Well, q to the p minus 1 is 1 mod p, of course, so that's going to be at least 1. Okay, be 1 for sure. But it might be more. You might get lucky and it might be 1 mod p squared. Second, count the number of times p divides the order of q in the cyclic group of, in the group of units mod m sub q, okay? Okay, so that might be 0, but you might be lucky and get some more, okay? And now, we've got BPMs, and now define f of m, okay? So big F of m is an integer with the same prime divisors as m, but with possibly different exponents, different multiplicities. And the multiplicities are given by the BPMs, okay? Okay. So, with one extra little restriction there, I can't take more than twice as many copies of a prime that was an M, okay, in big F of M. So that GCD of M squared is clamping off BPM. So I can't take a BPM too big, okay? All right, so here's the theorem then, okay? If N equals 4M squared is the order of a circulant head of our matrix, then big F of M is large, okay? It has to be at least M times B of M, okay? So darn close to M squared, okay? You can think of it that way. Okay. All right, so I'll use this a good bit in the latter part of the talk here, but I'll put up one more restriction on that we can use here on divisors of M that works in the Barker sequence problem, okay, though not in the circulant Hammer matrix problem. Okay, so Eliyahu, Kerber, and Safari showed that, well, if you have a length of a Barker sequence, if n's the length of a Barker sequence, okay, then all those odd prime divisors have to be 1 mod 4. Okay, so that'll be handy too. Okay. All right, so just a reminder, that's on Barker sequences only. The other ones were more broadly for the circulant head of our matrix problem. So some prior bounds in the broader problem, in the matrix problem. Okay, so Turin proved that the number M had to be at least 55. So if there's another circulant Hadamard matrix with length larger than 4, edge length larger than 4, it says edge length at least, well, 4 times that number squared. Okay, so 12,100. Okay. Schmidt brought this up to 165 and kind of in an earlier version of the result I cited. This is brought up to 11,715 a few years later. Okay. That's on M. And for the Barker sequence problem, we can give a similar list. Okay. So John Jedwab, together with Lloyd and Eliyahu and Kerber in 92, had a lower bound on M of 689 using the self-conjugacy restrictions. Schmidt, using the restriction 3 that I put up, brought this up to 10 to the 6, along with the 1 mod 4 restriction. Later with some additional computation and some refinements, Leung and Schmidt brought that up to 5 times 10 to the 10. So if there is another Barker sequence, then its length would have to be at least 10 to the 22. Okay? That's quite far out. Right? But the striking thing for me about the latter cases here was that no plausible value of M was even known that passed all the known restrictions. Okay? So this is just where they stopped searching, and not a single value passed all the restrictions. Okay? And in fact, they didn't even use self-conjugacy in that that pair. So they used their theorem, the 1 mod 4 bit, and of course the square part. Okay? And so, but no plausible value is even known. Okay? All right. So let's talk just a little bit about the strategy for what we want to look at here. So first, natural question, of course, is what's the smallest plausible value of N that at least passes all the known tests? Okay, let's find one that gets through. Okay, maybe there aren't any. Are there infinitely many possibilities for N in the Barker problem or in the circulant Hedemar matrix problem? We know the smallest one doesn't pass the test at 11,715. Okay, but are there infinitely many? How many are there up to X? Okay, roughly. So, the strategy I want to try here is, the Schmidt's criterion seems to be the hardest one to get by. So let's find an M that satisfies that criterion, okay, that restriction 3, right? And just as a reminder of how this worked, so remember big F of M was the product of the primes of the BPMs, and the BPMs, I need to make the BPMs big, okay? So the BPMs can be big in two ways. I can have P divide Q to the P minus 1 minus 1, or P divide the order of Q mod M sub Q. All right, so first up, we can write down a few simplifications to make things a little bit easier. Okay, so first of all, we may as well assume that f of m is m squared in the Barker problem, okay? At least for the range where we're going to look, okay? Note that f of m had to be at least m times phi of m, okay, which is this quantity here. And, f of m has the same prime divisors as m does, so if you're even one single prime short, say you're at most m squared over r for some prime r dividing m, then that remaining chunk here has to beat R. If I rearrange the equation a little bit, the product over all the primes dividing M, 1 over 1 minus P to the minus 1, has to be at least R. Well, that's going to grow really slowly. Even if I use a whole bunch of primes, that grows like log log X, even if I use all the primes up to X. And for the range I'm going to consider, I'll need to beat 5. 5's the smallest prime I could have in there, and that's not even going to come close to happening, okay? Okay, so we may as well assume that big F of M is M squared for the purposes of the computations, okay? In the Hadamard problem, I have the primes that are 3 mod 4, and if the stars just align just perfectly, then this actually could happen. So I got to give 3 sort of a free pass, and I could allow f of m to be m squared over 3. Okay, so that might happen. Okay. It's easy to see that we can assume that m is square free. Okay. For the purposes of doing these computations. So the BPMs depended only on the square free part of M. Okay? Remember that M sub Q was square free. Okay? So the idea is, if I have an admissible number M, then its square free part is automatically admissible. So we'll just look for the square free ones, and then we'll stick on extra prime factors and see if the BPMs can handle it. Okay? All right, so we'll assume M square free. All right, good. Now I only need that BPM is at least 2 for each prime P dividing M. Well, but 3 gets a free ticket. Okay. And third, just the easy observation that M certainly divides big F of M. That's just because that BPM is at least 1, since Q to the P minus 1 is already 1 mod P. Okay. All right, so I only need BPM is 2. Okay. So for each prime P dividing M, we only need, one of two things to happen. Okay. So 1, Q to the P minus 1 is 1 mod P squared. That would do the trick. Okay. Or 2, P divides the order of Q mod M over Q. Remember, as M is square free right now. Okay. For some prime Q dividing M. Okay. Either one of these would be fine. Okay. So in the former case, we'll say Q comma P is a V for X prime pair. Okay. These are well-studied things in number theory. Come up in a lot of problems that I'll mention in a minute here. And in the latter case, for this to even have a hope of working, then I'll need certainly P to divide, the order of that group, P of M over Q, so P will have to divide R minus 1 for some prime R dividing M, for that even to have a hope of working, okay? All right, so as an example then, we can look at, say, 689, just has 2 primes in it here. You compute B of 13 comma M, it comes out to be 1. You compute B of 53 comma M, that'll turn out to be 1 also, okay? So big F of 689 is 689. You can cross 689 off the list from using Schmidt's criterion. Okay. If you try this with 11,715, there it is, Well, 3 is covered by 71. Okay, so for P equals 3, I can pick Q equals 71. 71 squared is 1 mod 3 squared. So 71 sort of pays for 3. Okay. For P equals 5, the other side of the thing works. Okay, so the order of 3 mod M over 3 is, well, 140 divisible by 5. So for P equals 5, I can pick Q equals 3. Okay, in that other criterion. And of course, this was sort of armed because 5 divides, R minus 1 for a couple of primes in the list there. Okay, P equals 11. I could pick Q equals 3. That one works. 3 to the 10 is 1 mod 11 squared. And for P equals 71, I can pick Q equals 11. Q to the 70 is 1 mod Q squared. Okay, so everybody's covered. Okay, and big F of M is M squared, and I win. Okay, so 11,715 works. It's the smallest number that works. All right, so we want to find all the permissible numbers up to, well, a given parameter, say big M. Okay, so we want to design an algorithm to do this. And so the strategy will be to create a big directed graph. Okay, the vertices of the graph are the primes, abstractly all the primes up to M. In fact, we only need a subset of them. Okay, and we'll place a directed edge from Q to P, essentially whenever Q covers P. Okay. So if Q to the P minus 1 is 1 mod P squared, then, well, if I've got P in M, then, well, if Q is also in M, I'm covered, so I'll have a solid edge from Q to P. I'm absolutely solid about that. Okay, that's a good relationship. If P merely divides, for the other way, if P divides Q minus 1, well, then I've got a shot of this working if I pick some other prime R to look for this order criterion. It may or may not work, though. There's an element of chance here. So I'll call these flimsy edges. Okay, they're not very solid in the graph. Okay. All right. But you know, the idea in the graph then is that, well, if I've got an arrow from Q to M, from Q to P, then, well, if P's in my set, in my M, then if I have Q in there also, I'm either definitely covered or I've got a shot at being covered. Okay. All right. So that's the idea. Okay. All right. So then, at the end of the day, after constructing the graph, we want a subset of the vertices where each n degree is positive in the induced subgraph. Everybody's covered by somebody. Okay. So, well, in particular, then we need a cycle. Okay. So, one other comment here. So, in the Barker problem, well, of course, we'll only use primes that are 1 mod 4. In the circulant Hadamard matrix problem, well, we'll use all the primes, 1 mod 4, 3 mod 4. But 3 gets sort of a free pass, and well, that's easy to code up in here. We'll just add a flimsy edge from everything to 3, okay? So 3 is automatically covered by anybody, okay? Or at least it could be, right? We'll have to check it, of course, when you get these subgraphs, okay? Okay, so let's look at the example again with 11,715, okay? So here's the 4 relevant vertices in the graph. And remember, 71 covered 3, 3 covered 11, okay, and 11 covered 71. Okay. And both 11 and 71 sort of armed 5 to work also. Okay. So this is what the subgraph would look like here. Okay. So let's see. So next up, let me talk a little bit about Weierich pairs. Okay. Just various places they've come up in number theory. There's plenty of places where they've come up. Originally, they came up in the so-called first case of Fermat's last theorem, and this is where Weierich proposed their use. So remember, the first case means a solution to x to the p plus y to the p equals z to the p, where p doesn't divide x, y, or z. Okay. So Weierich showed this sort of an amazing property that if such a solution existed for a prime p, okay, then 2 comma p is a Weierich prime pair in my language. So 2 to the p minus 1 is 1 mod p squared. Okay. And these things are very rare. There's only 2 known, I believe. This was gradually extended over the years. It was shown that this Weierich condition would have to be true simultaneously if you had a solution to the first case of Fermat's last theorem for all prime bases Q up to 113 before the Wiles proof, of course. Okay, so in fact, Andrew Granville and Mike Monaghan had a nice paper in 1988 that showed, using this knowledge for Q up to 89 at the time, that FLT1 holds for all exponents P up to that gigantic number there, just because, well, these Weierich pairs have to be rather rare. Okay. Some other places in number theory where they've come up, famously in Catalan's conjecture, so in Mihalescu's recent proof, relied in part that if x to the p minus y to the q was 1, okay, then p comma q and q comma p are simultaneously Beaufort pairs. Okay. More recently, they've come up in the odd perfect number problem, for example. Pace-Nielsen's recent computations used in part knowledge of Beaufort pairs where q is a small Fermat prime, sort of one case of things you can consider. Another Erdős conjecture, every odd positive integer is the sum of a square free number and a power of 2. This is related to the Beaufort question, because, Granville and Sundararajan proved that, if this was true, then it would follow that there's infinitely many primes which are not Beaufort, okay, with base 2. Okay. Okay, so there's lots of these types of statements in number theory. This is just maybe a selection. Okay. Okay, so there's been plenty of attention given to searches for Beaufort pairs over the years. So for q equals 2, for example, here's kind of a selection of a few of these. Okay, so from as early as the 50s, D.H. Lamer in the early 80s, Richard Crandall, Carl Dilcher, Carl Pomerantz, to a large number in 1997. Josh Knauer was a student at Simon Fraser some years ago, and when he was at Dalhousie as an undergraduate with Jörg Rickstein, they brought this to 10 to the 15. Dominic Cleavy is a recent student of Carl Pomerantz's, I think, with Francois Doré, has the current record there. Okay. I don't want base 2, I want arbitrary bases, but this has received attention also. Usually where the base is a small number, not always. Okay, so here's a few prior searches. Probably John Brillhart, Peter Montgomery, 1993, Keller and Rickstein again. So we need sort of a bigger search where the bases Q can be rather large numbers too. Okay. So I want to describe some searches for Beaufort pairs, what I'll call Barker search 1. Okay. So we're just going to look at primes that are 1 mod 4. All right, so we'll construct the graph first, and the first thing we'll construct in the graph are those solid edges. And first, for the solid edges, we'll just look for the ascending pairs, so where base is less than exponent. Those are the hardest ones to find anyway. Okay. So, here's the table of searches that were done. So, for all prime bases q up to 10 to the 8, we'll look at all exponents up to 10 to the 8, where p is bigger than q. Okay. And then further, for prime bases q up to 10 to the 6, we'll take p up to 10 to the 9 and keep going this way. So this way we can, we'll get a lower bound on, we'll cover every possible pq, or, p comma q, where pq is less than or equal to, say, 10 to the 14 here in this case. Okay. So in that last row, that's just the prime 5, okay, 10 to the 14. Okay, so this produces 91,000 or so Beaufort pairs, okay, 175,000 primes. Okay, and so, we've got those ascending pairs, now let's build the descending pairs. Okay, so there's a lot more of these, now for every prime that we flagged before as being something we want to look at, find all Beaufort pairs where the prime p, the exponent, is bigger than the base. Okay, so look at all those. Of course, when you do this, you might come up with primes that you didn't find in your original set, so you may have to find even another jump down from there and reprocess on those primes. So you have to keep going until this stabilizes. Okay. All right, so this produces 224,000 descending solid links on now a total of 200,000 primes. All right, and then for your flimsy links, just look at all the primes in your set and look at all the prime divisors of p minus 1 for each prime in your set. Okay, and keep the ones that are 1 mod 4. This could, of course, give you new primes you haven't seen before. You have to go back to the Weaver search, then go back to this search, and keep going back and forth until the whole thing stabilizes. But you can do this. Okay. And so here's the picture for D. Then at the end, 217,000 vertices, 330,000 solid links, 240,000 flimsy links. Okay. All right. So now we need to find all cycles inside this graph. Okay. Well, cycle detection or cycle enumeration in large directed graphs is sort of a solved problem. There were a number of papers in the early 70s. So there's a paper by Robert Targin on that gives a very nice cycle enumeration algorithm. And, if you implement this and run it on this graph, you'll get 2,600 or so distinct cycles. Okay. All right. Our graph construction was enough to guarantee we found everything up to 10 to the 14. So my big M is 10 to the 14. In this case, only five have size 10 to the 14 or smaller. Okay, and here's just some of the cycles that came up. Here is a simple little two cycle. There's a double Wieferich prime pair where both the primes are 1 mod 4. It's the only one known. Beck, Heller, and Rickstein also found this pair. Here is a little three cycle, okay, with reasonably small primes, I guess. Here's a three cycle involving some flimsy links. And remember, when you got a flimsy link, you got to check that it actually works. Okay, so you have to go and check the order condition, and you're fine on 2953. But the worst case for you is when you have a small prime and you have a short cycle. Okay, and so 41, you lose here. You have a chance of like 1/41 of losing, and well, you're just unlucky in this case. That's an inadmissible number. Okay, so even though we get a cycle, we get an inadmissible thing. But remember, I just need little sub-pieces of this graph where everybody at n degree at least one, so you could sort of add on to your cycles, okay? And so here's a little window inside the graph of stuff that you can tack onto there. And if you tack on any one of those things, this gives you additional primes to look in that order test, okay? And you tack on any one of those and you're fine, okay? Okay, so you need cycle augmentation as well as cycle enumeration, so that can be done too. So one other cycle that comes up here. So I had five hanging off the last one. You can sort of keep hanging things off of this. So there's a flimsy link to this number near 2 million, and a solid link to 600, and a solid link to 4,000, and it then kind of goes off on its own here. Okay, so there's some fairly lengthy cycles. This is the longest one that came out of the algorithm. It says length 50. All right, so well beyond 10 to the 14, of course, but you'll get these long cycles coming up, too. So let's see. So you need a cycle augmentation algorithm, too, and I won't go into much detail here. We just kind of say what the parameters of the algorithm are. So the input is the digraph, okay, a given cycle, okay, and your bound, okay, M, okay. And your output is all induced subgraphs. You want to attach stuff onto your cycle and put on all possible attachments so that the product is less than M, okay. So all induced subgraphs G of D that, well, contain C, have, you know, product of the vertices less than your target number M, and you're just attaching things that you can reach from your original cycle, okay? Okay, so you can do this with kind of a nice little backtracking strategy, and you just want to, you know, try to take care not to reprint things you've already printed because you've written about your graph, okay? But this can all be done. Okay, so we've built some numbers then that pass the Schmidt test. Okay, so you got to sort of test the BPMs if they all work, but you've got built this set of numbers that work. Now we can put them into the self-conjugacy tests. And the easiest thing to try first is this large prime test. Okay, so does anybody have a prime that's bigger than n to the 2/3? So here are the five numbers under 10 to the 14 that pass everything, given that the flimsy links actually worked. And you can see one of them has a 5 squared in there. You can attach the BPM was big enough there to handle a 5 squared. Okay. Well, you can see that all these have big primes, have sizable primes, and if you go in and check these, the big prime test wipes out the first four of those right away. Okay. So the last one, it doesn't quite wipe out. The last one still survives. Okay. But you've got a little more ammunition. You could use your full Turin self-conjugacy test. Okay, and maybe there's some other way to pick R and S that'll wipe this thing out. Okay, and in this case, there is. Okay, so if I take R to be 5 times 2953, S is R squared times big prime squared, okay, you can just do the discrete log problems, and 5 to this giant number is minus 1 mod the 5 free part of S, and 2953 to that giant number give you minus 1 mod the 2953 part free part of S. And RS is bigger than, I guess it would be 2N in this case. Okay. And that wipes out the top one also. Okay. Okay. So the upshot is after Barker search one, nothing survived. Okay. So before we were up to 10 to the 22, now up to 10 to the 28. Okay. Okay. But we can do just a little bit, we can get a little bit further. Okay. Let's try Barker search two here without that much extra work by, sort of front loading the large prime test. Okay. So set M to be, another factor of 7 or so higher, okay, 10 to the 15 over root 2, okay. Okay, well, the large prime test then would automatically disqualify any number where P was bigger than 10 to the 10. Okay, and a whole lot of those things in the table have P bigger than 10 to the 10 anyway. I'm not even going to bother extending those out anymore. Okay? Okay, if I were to make any additional ones, they'd have a big prime in there, and they get wiped out by the large prime test. So I just had to extend the searches in the table where P and Q were both less than 10 to the 10, and there were only sort of one row in that table, which splits into two rows here, which had to be needed a factor of 7.5 more work here. Okay, so you do those, go through the same graph construction, now 250,000 vertices, 387,000 solid edges, 280,000 flimsy edges, and just run the whole thing, okay? And you find four additional candidates, okay? So here they are. Okay, and now the large prime test doesn't do anything, but you pull out the full Turin self-conjugacy test, and you get to erase the bottom one there. And you get to shoot down the third one there. Second one, down in flames. Okay. First one, you try to throw it away, okay, but no matter what you try, it just sort of drops back in on you, so you can't do a thing. It sticks around, and this one actually survives. Okay. So if there is a Barker sequence of length n bigger than 13, then, well, it's either that number, which is just over 10 to the 29, or you're beyond twice 10 to 10 to the 30. Okay. Right, so that's the only survivor. This one actually survives all of the tests. So let's see. So this was a Barker sequence specific search. Let's look at a circulant Hadamard matrix specific search. Okay. Scramble things up a little bit. So let's try. Now we want to set n to be a little bit smaller here. We'll have a much bigger graph. We'll have all the primes that are 3 mod 4. So we'll just set n to be 10 to the 13. We'll cut that down a little bit. We've already done all the Wieferich pair searches where P and Q are both 1 mod 4, so you just stick in the ones that are 3 mod 4, do all those searches, okay? And you get, a sizable graph here, so 640,000 vertices, 1.7 million solid edges now, about 2 million flimsy edges, okay? Remember in these flimsy edges, they have, these extra fake flimsy edges, faux flimsy edges, okay, going to 3. So this 200,000, of those edges, of those flimsy edges or extra edges that you threw into 3, okay, because 3 gets a free pass. Okay. When you run the cycle enumeration algorithm on this, you get an overwhelming number of cycles. So you augment it a little bit to only give you cycles that are length at most 12, which is all we care about because we want m only up to 10 to the 13. Okay. Okay. So this still produces 460,000 distinct cycles. Okay. But only 150 of them had a length up to less than 10 to the 13, okay? Okay, so, now put that into the cycle augmenter, okay, and that brings you up to 7,500, okay, when you attach things onto this thing, okay? Now you have to go through and remove those where the flimsy edges really didn't work, okay? But you'll have to also add in stuff where the BPMs were so big that you could stick on extra prime factors, okay? And when you do this, you have about 2,000 surviving numbers. And now put that into a self-conjugacy test, and you've been eliminated about a fourth of those. Okay, but that still leaves over 1,500 values less than 10 to the 13. Of course, I know the smallest one is 11,715. Okay, but now we've got a small list of numbers up to I guess it would be 4 times 10 to the 26. Okay, so there's at most that many candidates up to 4 times 10 to the 26. Okay, so here's a list of the smallest survivors. We go. This is a top 10 list, if you will, up to 5 million for M. So that would be up to 10 to the 14 for N. Okay, only 10 possibilities survive here. Okay. And let's see. Just a few speculations and things. Kind of closing out here. So natural question now is: now are there infinitely many N that would survive all these tests? And, how many are there up to X? What can you say about the density? Okay, so how about just a simple heuristic argument, okay, to estimate pairs QP, okay, which would survive in sort of the easiest way they can. You've got a double Wieferich prime pair, Q to P and P to Q, a little two-cycle, both solid edges, okay, both 1 mod 4, and Q can't be too large relative to P because of that large prime test. Okay, so P works out to be being Q, the larger prime, being between P and 2P squared. Okay. Why don't we count the number of these things and call them G2 of X. These are just little two cycles. Okay. And, we'll sum over, I'll count one every time I have Well, a prime P between 5 and root X, a prime Q between P and, well, that upper bound there, P and Q prime, both 1 mod 4, and the double V4X condition works out. Okay. So can we estimate this? Okay. Well, just heuristically at least, why don't I sum over all integers Y from 5 to root X and Z up to, well, that quantity up there from Y up to that quantity. Okay. So Y is not taking the role of P, Z is taking the role of Q. Okay. And now I want them both to be prime. Hey, well, that happens, well, for Y, it happens with probability 1 over log Y. For Z, it happens with probability 1 over log Z. Let's see. So I need the double V4X condition to work out. And, well, Q to the P minus 1, it's already 1 mod P. So it's got to be something mod P squared. So there's P different choices right there. So with probability 1 over P, let's say, it'll land on the right residue just by accident. Okay. So I need both of those to work out. So I need a 1 over YZ down in there. Okay. And that covers just about everything except they're both 1 mod 4, so, well, we'll stick that on there, too. Okay, so half of them. Okay. So we could estimate this and get at least a heuristic argument for what we should get out of this, for how many there should be up to X. Okay, so, just kind of work out what the sum would be. This just splits up the sum over Z into the two pieces. Okay, and... let's see, and then, well, I'll estimate this with some integrals and just sort of go ahead and crank out what those integrals would be, and this just turns out to be, like a constant times dy over y log y up to root x, okay, which looks like log log x. Okay, so just in that simple case of counting two cycles up to x, heuristically we'd expect log log x of them, so there should be at least infinitely many, okay? Can you say more than this? I'm only counting two cycles here, but could you come up with a good estimate for three cycles and four cycles and five cycles and sum over that? Can you put in the flimsy lengths, see what would happen there? Presumably it would be a lot more than this, but could you get a power up log or something like that? Okay. I don't know. Okay, even heuristically. Okay. This is a heuristic argument, and the tricky part in the heuristic argument was that 1 over YZ, saying, well, with probability 1 over P, I'll land on that residue class 1 mod P squared. Okay? And that's the sticking point. Could you do this? We don't need this for any particular prime P, but we just need to sort of need it on average. Let's say fix a prime Q less than X. Okay? So what we want is the number of primes P, okay, with P less than X and Q to the P minus 1 is 1 mod P squared is about log log X. We kind of like that. So this isn't known for any fixed prime Q. These problems seem to be really tough. It'd be fine if we just knew that this happened on average over all the primes. So maybe there's some kind of averaging statement you could say here. And there is an averaging statement in the literature for this by Murata in 1981. It says that log log X is right on average if you average over all the bases up to X. Okay? And I want all the prime bases. Okay. But the exceptional set size in this paper is much larger than the set of primes. So the exceptional set could swallow up all the primes, in fact, here. So we don't get anything out of this. Okay, so the exceptional set size is like x over log log x to the power. Making that heuristics into a firmer proof looks to be a tough problem. But even coming up with sort of better heuristics, I think would be interesting to see how many you expect in either problem circulant Hadamard matrix or Barker sequence problem. Okay. Let's see. Yeah. I'd like to stop there. So thanks very much.
Well, thanks, Mike, for your entertaining and interesting talk. Are there any questions from Fields?
Any questions? Michael, it's Igor Spolinsky from Fields. Do you have any estimates on the counting function from the above? So the upper bounds are not so much out of reach.
Do I have any estimates for what, I'm sorry?
An upper bound on the counting function. You count all m's up to x, which satisfy all the conditions,
and you want
to have an upper bound.
Oh, no, I don't have an upper bound.
This would be
the trivial thing like root x or something, but not a reasonable upper bound.
Okay, thank you. That was my question. Other questions? I think that's it from this side.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions from Ermax? Yes, here's one.
Yeah. when you did these searches, what was the limiting factor in the search? Was it finding the nodes to start with? Was it constructing the graph? Was it finding the cycles? Or
The limiting factor is the Beaverick pair searches. Okay, so that by far was, and the graph construction was the most time. That was all told, it would be, I don't know, a few years of CPU time probably that went into the those table constructions.
Are there any other questions from Ermax?
If I count as being from Ermax, yes. That was quite a computational tour de force. It's amazing how much work it takes to get that far. How far do you think you can take this?
Well, let's see. There's. I thought you might be able to get some work out of by treating the two cycles as a special case, because you can get some information, extra information, just about two cycles, and then working out three cycles, you'd be able to go further because your worst case wouldn't just be a product of two primes, it'd be a product of three primes. So that might be able to take you a little bit further. But other than that, computationally, well, I don't know, it depends on how many cores you can run these things on, because right now this was on the order of a few years computation time. Right? So with a big multi-core machine, maybe this could be taken out a good bit further.
And a follow-up question. So the Barker polynomials have maximum order correlations size 1. What did you put the restriction that the maximum order correlations were size 2? Do the same techniques work?
Oh, let's see. You certainly expect just a finite number of these also. Well, that would be the conjecture, right? They'd run out. I'd have to think about how this would work in the problem and see how this would work there. So I don't know offhand what the answer to the question would be.
Thank you.
Mike?
Yes.
John Borwain at Ermax. Your remaining candidate for a Barker sequence, are there strategies for ruling it out?
Not that I know of.
So there's no way to sort of do an incomplete version of a Barker sequence or something and limit what you need to learn that way? I mean, sort of cruder exclusion bounds once you have a given candidate?
I'd have to talk to you about it later. Not that I know of, at least. Yeah.
And a question, another one here.
Are there infinitely many values of n for which we're going to pass all of the known conditions for the existence of a Barker sequence?
Oh, well,
non-existent.
Yeah, I suspect the answer is yes, right? But I don't have a proof of this, right? So yeah, so that lower bound of log x is the only thing I've worked out as far as a heuristic would go. But even that for writing down a proof, that seems to be pretty tough.
Any more questions here? No? Well, let's thank Mike again and all of the speakers in the session.